Hello, welcome back to WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. This is your host, Irvi Banerjee, and you're back on Tech Unfiltered. Previously, we were just talking about, obviously, other technologies that are constantly shaping the world, but the section or the segment that I'm going to be talking about with you today is a little different. Because I've never really looked into this type of technology. I won't say that I never knew about it, but I was aware, but I never thought about looking into it. And now I am, and now we're going to talk about a few things about it. So let's take an example. So when you walk through an airport and you enter a public space or even a busy street, there's a chance that even somewhere nearby, a camera is capturing your image. And this is no secret. This is very obvious because now with the rise of technology, there's the rise of surveillance. So most of the time, we don't think about it. I don't know about you, but when I'm walking down the street, I'm not really thinking about whether a camera is watching me. Cameras almost feel normal now. They're part of everyday life. They are used for security, traffic monitoring, and public safety. But cameras today are not just recording, they are analyzing. Facial recognition technology has transformed cameras from passive observers into active systems that can identify, track, and verify individuals in real time. At its core, facial recognition is about turning a human face into data. To understand how this works, imagine looking at a face and trying to describe it to someone else. You might mention maybe the specific mole on their face, or the shape of their nose, or the curve of their jawline, or maybe the position their eyebrows are, if they're unique in any way. So when a camera captures an image like facial recognition systems do, they do something similar but with a lot more precision. This step is called face detection. It separates the face from the background and identifies key regions. And next comes feature extraction. The system maps specific points on the face, often called landmarks. These might include the corners of the eyes, the tip of the nose, the edges of the lips, and the outline of the face. Each of these points is converted into numerical values. So think of it like turning a face into a coordinate system. Instead of saying, yeah, this is a person, the system creates a unique mathematical representation of the face. This representation is sometimes called a face print. A face print is not an image, it's a string of numbers that describes the structure of a face. Once a face print is created, it can be compared to other face prints stored in a database. If a match is found, the system can identify the person. And if no match is found, the system just stores the new face print for future reference. So, now let's imagine this process happening not once, but thousands or even millions of times. This is how large-scale facial recognition systems operate. They continuously scan faces, convert them into data, and compare them against vast databases. Governments use these systems in a variety of ways. One of the most common applications is in border control. At many airports, travelers can pass through automated checkpoints where cameras scan their faces and match them to passport photos. This speeds up the verification process and reduces the need for a manual inspection. Another use is in law enforcement. Facial recognition can help identify suspects by comparing images from security cameras to criminal databases. For example, if a camera captures footage of a person involved in a crime, that image can be analyzed and matched against known records. This can significantly reduce investigation time. And some cities also use facial recognition in public surveillance systems. There's cameras placed in streets, transportation hubs, public buildings, so they can monitor activity in real time. For example, if a person on a very wanted watch list is detected, authorities can be alerted immediately. To understand the scale of this, think of it like a search engine for faces. So instead of typing a name into a search bar, the system takes an image and searches for a match across millions of records. This capability raises important questions. One of the biggest concerns is accuracy. Facial recognition systems, like all systems, are not perfect. Their performance can vary depending on factors such as lighting, camera angle, image quality, and even differences in facial expressions. Studies have shown that some systems have higher error rates for certain demographic groups. So this can lead to false positives, where a person is incorrectly identified as someone else. In a law enforcement context, a false positive can have extremely serious consequences. However, there's another concern is scale. Unlike traditional identification methods, facial recognition does not require active participation. You do not need to present an ID or enter a password. Your face can be captured and analyzed without your awareness. This makes it possible to track individuals across multiple locations without direct interaction. To understand this, let's say you're walking through a city where every camera is connected to a system that can recognize you. Every time you pass a camera, your location is recorded. Over time, this creates a detailed record of your movements, and this is where facial recognition intersects with surveillance. Surveillance is not something new. We've been very normalized to it, and it's something with the rise of technology has been a cause, like effect of the rise of technology. But governments have always monitored certain activities for security purposes. But facial recognition increases the scale and efficiency of surveillance dramatically. It automates what would otherwise require large numbers of people. Another key issue is data storage. Facial recognition systems rely on large databases of face prints. These databases must be stored securely and as they contain sensitive information. So if such data is compromised, it can't really be easily changed. Unlike a password, you can't replace your face. This makes data protection very critical for databases like this. But there's also questions about consent. In many cases, individuals are not explicitly asked whether they agree to have their faces scanned and stored. For example, when you go through the airport and you scan your passport before the TSA line, yeah, they ask you whether they can like scan your face. Like you have a choice whether to stand in front of the scanner or not. But most of the time, such as in public surveillance, you don't have a choice. There could be a camera in place and there couldn't be. So this raises ethical concerns about privacy and individual rights. Some countries have implemented strict regulations on the use of facial recognition. These regulations may limit where and how the technology can be used, require transparency, or mandate oversight. Other countries have adopted broader use of that technology, particularly in areas such as public safety and national security. The differences in approach reflect broader debates about the balance between security and privacy. Facial recognition is often justified as a tool for improving safety. It can help locate missing people, identify threats, and streamline processes. But at the same time, it introduces a new form of monitoring that weren't previously possible at this scale, especially. To better understand this balance, let's say imagine like a library where every book you read is recorded automatically. So the system knows what you read, when you read it, and how often you return to certain topics. This information could be useful for recommendations or research, but it also could feel invasive if used without your knowledge or consent that there's this big database that knows every single thing that you read. So facial recognition operates in a similar way. It collects information that can be useful, but also raises questions about how that information is used. Another important aspect is how these systems evolve. Facial recognition technology is improving rapidly. Advances in computer vision and data processing are making systems more accurate and efficient. At the same time, new techniques are being developed to detect and prevent misuse. For example, some researchers are working on methods to identify when facial recognition is being used inappropriately. Others are developing technologies that allow individuals to protect their identity, such as clothing or accessories designed to confuse recognition systems. This creates an ongoing cycle of development. As recognition systems improve, so do the methods that counter them. And as new concerns emerge, regulations and policies continue to adapt. Facial recognition is just one example of how governments are using technology to manage and understand populations. But not only governments, these data could be used by researchers and many other individuals. It represents a shift from reactive systems, where action is taken after an event occurs, to proactive systems that monitor how people move, interact, and how they perceive their environment. And then, on top of this, the facial recognition monitoring all this also causes people, it affects the people who are actually getting affected by this, such as a person walking across the street. Now they might act differently, they might interact differently, they might do things differently. And there's been a lot of debate of whether that's good or bad, of how people are having to change their behavior in order to not be detected, because these machines are looking at how people move and interact and all that stuff. So the presence of surveillance can lead individuals to try not to do anything wrong. And even if they aren't even doing anything wrong. So understanding facial recognition is not just about understanding a technology. It's about understanding how that technology fits into larger systems of power, governance, and society. It's about recognizing that technology does not operate in isolation. It is shaped by the choices of those who design, deploy, and regulate it. And it, in turn, shapes the experiences of those who live within those systems. So as we move forward, facial recognition will likely become more integrated into everyday life. It may appear in more devices, more services, and more public systems. The key question is not whether the technology will exist, because it already does. The question is how it will be used. Who controls it, who benefits from it, and how its risks are managed. Because at the end of the day, facial recognition is not just about identifying faces, it's about defining the relationship between individuals and the systems that observe them. And that relationship will play a major role in shaping the future of technology and society. So that is our little segment on facial recognitions. And on the next segment, we're going to be looking at a few tracking technologies that governments and other organizations use. But before we go on our quick music break, here is a quick PSA. Programming on WEFT is presented in part by the Rose Bowl Tavern in downtown Urbana. The Rose Bowl Tavern features live music and entertainment 7 days a week. RoseBowlTavern.com is always up to date with details and information. The Rose Bowl Tavern in downtown Urbana. So yeah, that's just our little segment, and we will go on a quick music break, and we will go straight into some tracking technology that organizations use. Hello, welcome back to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. And just previously, we were talking about facial recognition systems, and now we're going to be talking about some, like, tracking systems that organizations use. So when people think about surveillance, obviously people think about cameras. I think about cameras when I think about surveillance. But in reality, one of the most powerful forms of monitoring today has nothing to do with faces. It has to do with movement. Where you go, how you travel, how often you visit certain places, how long you stay, and what routes you take. All of this can be tracked, recorded, and analyzed using systems that most people interact with every day without even noticing. One of the most clearest examples of this is license plate recognition. License plate recognition systems, often called ALPR systems, use cameras combined with software to identify and record vehicle license plates. At first glance, this might seem simple. A camera takes a picture of a car and the system reads the plate number. But in reality, it's a lot more complex than that. These systems are designed to operate at high speeds and in a variety of conditions. They can capture images of moving vehicles even at night or in bad weather. Once an image is captured, software isolates the license plate and converts the character into text. The text is then stored along with additional information such as time, date, and location of the capture. Over time, this creates a record of where a vehicle has been. To understand how powerful this is, think about driving through a city where cameras are placed at intersections, highways, parking lots, and public roads. Each time your car passes one of these points, your license plate is recorded. Individually, each record may not seem significant, but when combined, they create a pattern. This pattern can show daily routines, travel habits, and frequently visited locations. It's essentially like a map of movement. Governments and law enforcement agencies use ALPR systems for a variety of purposes. They can help locate stolen vehicles, track suspects, and monitor traffic patterns. So, for example, if a car is reported stolen, its license plate can be added to a watch list. If a system detects that plate, it can alert authorities in real time. This allows for faster response and recovery. But beyond these targeted uses, ALPR systems also collect large amounts of general data. Even vehicles that are not connected to any investigation may still be recorded. Because just because you, let's say, pass a camera at an intersection doesn't mean that it won't take a picture of your license plate. This raises questions about how long the data is stored and how it's used. Another major tracking system involves mobile devices. Most people carry a smartphone, and that device constantly interacts with networks. And even when you're not actively using it, your phone communicates with cell towers, Wi-Fi networks, and sometimes GPS satellites. Each of these connections provides location information. Each of these connections provide location information and so much more. Cell tower data works by measuring which tower your phone is connected to. As you move, your phone switches between towers. By analyzing these connections, it's possible to estimate your location and track your movement over time. Wi-Fi networks can also be used for tracking. When your phone searches for available networks, it sends out signals that can be detected by nearby systems. These signals include unique identifiers associated with your device. This means that even without connecting to a network, your presence can be detected. GPS provides even more precise location data. It uses signals from satellites to calculate your exact position on Earth. Many apps use GPS to provide services such as navigation, weather updates, or location-based recommendations. But this same data can be used for tracking. Governments may access location data through legal processes depending on the laws in the specific place. In some cases, whether it be investigative data or anonymized data, it's used essentially to analyze population movement. For example, during large events or emergencies, location data can help understand how people are moving and where resources are needed. To visualize this, think of each person as leaving behind a trail of digital footprints. Each step, each stop, each route adds another point to the trail. Individually, these points may not reveal much, but when connected, they form a detailed picture. Another layer of tracking comes from public transportation systems. Many transit systems use digital cards or mobile apps for payment. Each time a person enters or exits a station, the system records the transaction. This data can show travel patterns across the city. Similarly, toll systems on highways often use electronic tags or cameras to record vehicles as they pass through. Again, this all creates a record of movement. Now, let's consider combining all of these systems: license plate data, phone location data, transit records, and other sources. When integrated, they provide a highly detailed understanding of movement at both individual and population levels. This is where data analysis becomes important. Raw data alone is not at all useful, but when processed and analyzed, it can reveal patterns, trends, and anomalies. For example, analysts can identify unusual movement patterns that may indicate suspicious activity. They can also study traffic flow to improve infrastructure planning. Another application is predictive analysis. By studying past data, systems can make predictions about future behavior. For instance, traffic management systems can anticipate congestion and adjust signals accordingly. Emergency services can position resources based on expected demand. However, predictive systems can also introduce challenges. Predictions are based on patterns, and patterns are not always accurate representations of individual behavior. This can lead to incorrect assumptions or decisions. Another important aspect to consider in data retention. This is the same thing we saw in facial recognition. When, let's say, a system wrongly accuses a person of having done this crime based on the fact that their face may look similar to another person's face, it really comes into question about whether this technology is beneficial in wide scale. So going back to the tracking and all the government systems that they're using, how long should movement data be stored? Some systems may keep data for, let's say, short periods, while others may store it for years. Long-term storage increases the potential for detailed analysis, but also raises the concerns about privacy. Security is also critical. Just like the facial recognition systems, large data sets containing movement information must be protected from unauthorized access. If such data is compromised, it can be used in harmful ways, such as most data that is stored nowadays. For example, knowing someone's daily routine could make them vulnerable to targeted actions. And there's also the issue of transparency. Many people are not fully aware of how much movement data is being collected or how it's being used. On top of that, not many companies are very transparent about how they use that data, or may be vague about how they use it. So this lack of awareness can make it difficult to have informed decisions about the technology from the user side, especially because you don't know the full side of the story from both sides. So some regions have introduced regulations to address these concerns. These regulations may require limits on data collection, clear purposes for use, and accountability for misuse. They may also provide individuals with rights to access or delete their data. But regulations vary widely depending on the country or simply the place that you're in. In some places, tracking systems are used extensively with not many restrictions. In others, their use is more limited. This creates a global landscape where the same technology can have very different implications. To understand the impact, let's imagine a city where every road has sensors and can record every vehicle that passes. Now imagine this information is stored and analyzed, and city planners can use it to improve traffic flow. But at the same time, it could be used to track individual movements. So this same data that we are looking into serves multiple purposes. So this dual nature is a common theme in government technology. Systems designed for efficiency and safety can also be used for monitoring and control. The outcome depends on how they're implemented and governed. Tracking technologies are becoming more advanced. New systems are being developed that can analyze not just where people go, but how they move. These patterns can be used to detect unusual activity, but at the same time, new methods are being explored to protect that privacy. Techniques such as anonymization aim to remove identifying information from data. So, however, complete anonymousness is difficult to achieve, especially when multiple data sets are combined. So each data point can sometimes be re-identified by linking it with other information. So this highlights the complexity of managing modern tracking systems. Because it's not just about the technology anymore. It's about the policy, the ethics, and the decision-making. As these systems continue to evolve, they will obviously play an increasingly important role in how cities operate. But they have the potential to improve efficiency and hence safety and provide valuable insights. But they also require careful consideration to ensure that they do not compromise individual rights. Because at the end of the day, tracking systems are not just about data. They're about people. And they're about how movement, behavior, and patterns are understood and interpreted. And as with all powerful technologies, the key question is not what they can do, but how they should be used. And as I said before, at the end of the day, these are about people. You are tracking people. It is about people's behaviors and patterns. So people do have the rights of whether they can participate in it or not. So that's just a little bit about how tracking technologies. Obviously, there's so much more. There's so much more I probably missed. There's so much more tracking and surveillance technology that we may not even know about. But I believe that these are some that the public may be aware of. Well, most people or some people may be aware of. And there's just two sides of the story. There's that safety side, but there's also the privacy side. So there isn't really just one solution because, as with all problems, I don't believe there's always one solution that can just obviously help because there will always be some negative effect to it. So before we get into the next subject, which will be a little bit about cybersecurity and those type of systems, I have a quick PSA. From the Joshua Tree Inn is posted by Kevin Elliott every Tuesday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. Folk, country, bluegrass, singer-songwriter, Americana, rock, blues, jazz, Celtic, and many more regions in between. Listening to music from the Joshua Tree Inn is like attending an acoustic music festival with the best contemporary flow, country, bluegrass, and more. So pack your bags for Newport or Telluride and enjoy the finest in acoustic songs with Kevin Elliott every Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. So this is WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM, and we are going to go on a quick music break before we jump into our next segment. Hello, welcome back to WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. We just talked about tracking and all those type of things, but now we're going to be jumping right into cyber technology, cyber, like digital control, national security systems, all that type of stuff. So when people think about warfare, they often imagine like physical spaces like lands, borders, ocean, and airspace. They picture soldiers, vehicles, and visible forms of conflict. But today there's another domain where conflict takes place. It is invisible, continuous, and often happens without public awareness. That domain is where that domain that where it sits is called cyberspace. Cyber warfare is the use of digital systems to disrupt, damage, or gain control over another nation's infrastructure, information, or operations. So unlike traditional warfare, cyber warfare does not always involve physical destruction. Instead, it targets systems that modern societies depend on. To understand this, let's think about the digital infrastructure we use today. Electrical power grids, water systems, transportation networks, financial systems, and communication platforms. They all depend on computers and networks. If those systems are disrupted, the effects can be widespread. Cyber operations can take many forms. One common method is distributed denial of service attack, often called the DDoS attack. In a DDoS attack, a system is overwhelmed with traffic from multiple sources. So basically, let's say you're trying to enter a building, but thousands of people are rushing through the door at the same time. It blocks the access. So the system becomes overloaded and cannot function properly. Another type of cyber operation involves malware. Malware is often a software designed to damage or gain unauthorized access to systems. It can be used to steal information, disrupt operations, or take control of devices. Some malware operates quietly, collecting data without being detected. Other types are more aggressive, shutting down systems or corrupting data. One of the most significant examples of cyber warfare involves a piece of malware known as Stuxnet. Stuxnet targeted industrial control systems, specifically those in nuclear facilities. So instead of just stealing the data, it altered how the machines operated. It caused physical equipment to behave incorrectly while reporting normal conditions to operators. This showed that cyber attacks could have real-world physical consequences. And to understand how this works, consider an industrial system as a set of instructions controlling machines. If those instructions are changed, even slightly, the machines may perform actions that lead to damage. So it's like giving incorrect directions to a driver. The car itself works fine, but it ends up in the wrong place. Cyber warfare often focuses on critical infrastructure. Power grids are a common target because they are essential to almost every aspect of society. If electricity is disrupted, it affects communication, transportation, healthcare, and more. Water systems are another target. These systems rely on automated controls to manage treatment and distribution. If those controls are compromised, it could affect water quality or availability. Transportation systems, including air traffic control and rail networks, also depend on digital systems. Interference in these systems could lead to delays, confusions, or safety risks. Financial systems are also, on top of that, very sensitive. Banks, stock markets, and payment networks rely on secure and reliable data processing. Cyber attacks in this area could disrupt economic activity or undermine trust. Another important aspect of cyber warfare is information. Governments may use digital platforms to influence public perception. This can involve spreading misinformation, altering data, or disrupting communication channels. Unlike physical attacks, these actions are harder to detect and attribute. Attribution is one of the biggest challenges in cyber warfare. In a traditional conflict, it's often clear who is responsible for an action. In cyberspace, identifying the source of an attack can be difficult. Attackers can route their activities through multiple systems in different locations, making it harder to trace them. This creates a level of uncertainty, and responses to cyber attacks must consider the possibility of misidentifying someone, acting on incorrect assumptions, and could escalate conflicts unnecessarily. To defend against cyber threats, governments invest in cybersecurity. Cybersecurity involves protecting systems, networks, and data for unauthorized access or damage. This includes measuring such as encryption, firewalls, intrusion detection systems, and regular monitoring. Encryption is a key component. It transforms data into a coded format that can only be read with the correct key. And even if the data is intercepted, it cannot be understood without decryption. And firewalls act as barriers in order to keep other people who are unauthorized to stay out. So all of this, cyber warfare, represents a fundamental shift in how conflict is understood. And cybersecurity allows a solution for that. So this is allowing us to move beyond physical space into a domain where information systems and infrastructure are the primary targets. It operates continuously, often without clear boundaries or visibility, and it requires new approaches to defense, cooperation, and policy. Understanding cyber warfare is not just about understanding technology, it's about understanding how modern societies, like the facial recognition and the trackers, are implemented into society and how they can be protected and how we as people can be protected. Because in the end of the day, these technologies are meant to protect us, and they are meant to protect us, and they should be protecting us. So that is on the segment of Tech Unfiltered. I hope you have a great day and you are on WEFT Champagne 90.1 FM, and I will see you next week.